Spring, is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. These must-have travel shoes have a lighter-than-air feel and barely-there fit that made them the most packable shoes ever. That means more comfort and less baggage. Try the Superlight Tree Runner with a cushy foam midsole and breathable eucalyptus fiber upper. Plus, they're comfy right out of the box. So, what can you do in a Superlight shoe? What can't you do is the better question. And because they're super packable, the real question is, where are you taking them? Experience how Allbirds redefines comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's ALLBIRDS.com, code SUPER24.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
So you might have heard tell, or maybe at least noticed, that in the social media age, anybody that wants a voice can now have a voice in the public forum. That's for good and bad. But for a lot of communities that have kind of lacked a voice previously, social media has been a way to bring awareness and attention to the things that affect their lives greatly. For example, take autism. Folks that have been somewhere on the autism spectrum now have a way to not only reach out to other people, but to raise awareness and to talk about what's going on in their affected lives. This means that folks that have grown up that are autistic, and also their parents and caregivers of people that are autistic, they want a voice not only in explaining their own lives, but they want a hand in how they are portrayed in media and in the wider world. And they also want a say in policy and things that affect them politically. So culture and politics crossing paths with something like autism, which can be a very touchy and sensitive topic, leads to having problems. Case in point, recently the Today Show had a headline on a segment, and it was, quote, "Why There's a War Between Parents of Children with Autism and Autistic Adults," end quote. Well, that doesn't sound good, and people actually push back at the framing itself, but it brings up the issue of how media, social media, people with autism, people without autism are all kind of clashing in the social media realm. So what do we do with such a touchy topic that crosses so many streams? Well, we want to reach out to our friend Eric Garcia. He has a great new book out called We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Now, Eric is a journalist of great note. He's worked everywhere from places like The Hill, Washington Post, National Journal, Roll Call. He's written all over the place. He's a journalist by trade, and he is autistic himself, but he didn't write just a straight memoir of himself. He wrote this book using people to tell the story, letting them portray themselves. And then he delves into things like policy and politics and the cultural perceptions of autism, using those stories and those people filtered through his journalism instincts and with a little touch of his own personal story. So Eric is the perfect person to ask about when we see things in social media like the autism debate and explaining to the rest of us how we should approach these things. What's the appropriate way to talk about them? And then when we go to things like politics and policy, how do we make those things more accessible but also listen to the voices of the people that it'll affect the most? Eric Garcia is going to be the perfect person to talk about this. He's a great guy. He's been a good friend for a while and a good Twitter buddy, so I'm excited to get to talk to him about his great book, We're Not Broken, and we're going to get to do that right on Heard Tell, right now, right after this. I'm absolutely delighted to have my friend Eric Garcia finally talking on the phone. We've been Twitter buddies for a long time, so I'm thrilled you're joining me, buddy. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me. It's good to finally like hear your voice and like, you know, I've listened to the podcast, but it's good to like actually interact.
Yeah, it's a great thing. We've been trying to kind of miss each other last because we're both really busy with the real world stuff. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of the book. Before we delve into the book itself, though, how does something like autism explode into the culture and politics realm? Because I know social media is a big part of it, but you have these pieces on morning shows, kind of the Oprah-type stuff, but then you have the science stuff. How did we get to this point where autism is really in the front and center of a lot of cultural and politic discourse right now?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's gone through a bunch of different cycles. So one of the fascinating things when I was going through book research, it's always funny. It's always weird going back and seeing how things are talked about in the past. So like in the 1960s, you know, someone like Brutal Bettelheim was on like talk shows all the time. And Leo Kanner, who was the first person who discussed autism really in the United States, he would be quoted in Time magazine. But I think that you really see a big change in how it's discussed starting around the 2000s, and I think it was because in the 1980s and the 1990s, you started to see an increased, you see better diagnostic criteria being created in the DSM. It's important to remember that autism didn't get its own separate diagnosis from schizophrenia until 1980. Up until then, it was seen as a symptom of schizophrenia. And if you go back and you read a lot of like old interviews, they use almost kind of autism and childhood schizophrenia almost interchangeably, one thing I've noticed. Then what happened is in 1990, with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, what happened was then schools had to report how many students were receiving services. They had to report that to the federal government. And the IDEA specifically included autism. So that meant that you saw more diagnoses in the 1990s and in the 2000s than you had in the past. So it really, I think people thought that you were seeing an increase or an epidemic, as you saw a lot of news stories talk about autism. But really, it was just there was better diagnosis. We were getting better understanding. We realized it was much more common. And I think what also happened is that you had a lot, the other difference is that there was a lot of money behind it. So what happened is in the 2000s, Bob Wright, who was the head of NBC Universal, and his wife Suzanne, they helped start Autism Speaks. And really what you need for anything to get into the public sphere is it really needs to affect somebody super wealthy. Right. And super rich. So the fact that this happened and the fact that it was the head of a multinational media corporation spearheading this effort, that brought it into the public sphere and the public dialogue. And I think that still shapes how we talk about it, because there still is a narrative about because I think there still is a focus on how parents feel or how caretakers feel. And there still isn't a lot of focus on how do autistic people feel. But the difference is, I think now, as opposed to like the 2000s, I think you saw this especially in the 2010s, and then now especially today, you've seen a lot of those kids who got the diagnoses in the 1990s and in the 2000s, and they got the services, although they were far from the windfall that they were supposed to be, they've grown up now, and now they're able to push back and they're able to speak out. So you can no longer just do anything. You can no longer talk about autism without expecting autistic people to talk back, so to speak.
Yeah, and you've talked about it not just in the book, but as you've done the kind of the promotional stuff with the book and telling your story that led you to do the book. Part of the story of autism, it is a very young science. It, like you said, we've only really used the terms from like 1906, I believe you said.
1911.
1911,
yeah. 1911, yeah.
And then, so we're talking, you know, 1980s, you're talking only about 40 years. This is almost like the opposite of what we've seen with the COVID stuff lately, where the science ran way ahead and now everybody's trying to catch up. A lot of that stuff you're talking with the parents, it was the opposite, where the parents and the caregivers, they were running way ahead of the science and then trying to beg the science to, hey, can you re-examine this and kind of get to where we're at on it? Because it got thrown into the psychiatric realm. It got thrown into the institutional realm, and they wanted it moved into the fore. And that's a big part of the story that leads to what you deal with in the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, in Jack Pitney, who wrote a great book called The Politics of Autism, it's a very academic read, but if you had the patience to do it, it's a very quick read. It's only like 200 pages. He noted that in the 1970s, what was interesting is, if you remember in the 1970s, there was really this kind of push for consumer health safety or good government things. Like there was Ralph Nader put out books like Unsafe at Any Speed, and there was talks about leaded gasoline. That did it because autism was seen as a personal failing. Parents were, you know, they used to call them refrigerator parents, as unloving parents, and that was what caused autism. That when it became then something that existed in the personal realm, and it wasn't seen as something that would that public policy could address at the same time, but. It was really parents like Bernard Rimland, though he would kind of go off the rails later, and Ruth Christ Sullivan, who tried initially pushing back when and tried including autism in the larger discussion about disability. So, for example, in the 1970s, when the Developmental Disabilities Act was reauthorized or was passed, the second part of the legislation had the establishment of the protection of rights of persons with developmental disabilities. And parents pushed really hard to include explicitly autism, as persons with developmental disabilities have a right to appropriate treatment, services, and habilitation for such disabilities. But they were often pushing back against scientists, against professors, among academics, pushing back against academics. So they were really, and what's interesting, and I read about this in the book, one person who was following this early on was the First Lady of Arkansas, Hillary Clinton, because she was living in Arkansas at the time, and she became really good friends with the mother of an autistic son in the 1970s. And having studied at the Yale Child Study Center, she had seen all the science on autism, but then meeting this one mother, she realized, wait, maybe we have the science on this wrong. And then, of course, the science proved that it wasn't caused by unloving mothers. It was caused, you know, it's genetics. So, but like you said, it was parents pushing back, and then now it's autistic people pushing back. But like you said, it was like, it was advocates outside of the academic realm really trying to push back on this kind of sanitized and almost medicalized language around it.
And I love that you bring up the language right there, because something I wanted to ask you about, especially listening to all the interviews you've been given, and you've kind of, you know, the article, you've talked about the article that led to the book was kind of your first real public discussing of you being autistic yourself. Yeah. You've talked a lot about the terminology, and I wanted to ask you about this because it really, really struck me. But you talked about how misusing terms like high functional, low functional, these sorts of things, and the term you used was, you said that flattens the experience. Can you explain that to folks? Because that really struck home to me. My mom was a special ed teacher. That's language I've heard from her for years and years and years. But flattening the experience is huge when you're dealing with a group of folks like this that are trying to get their voices heard.
Yeah, and you know this, and actually West Virginia, your mom could probably attest to this. West Virginia was one of the first states that focused on autism specifically. And it's interesting to me because I think that if you say that someone is high functioning, like a lot of people would say that I'm high functioning, and I think even like 5 or 6 years ago, I would have said I was high functioning. But I think what happens is that when you say someone is high functioning, that almost erases their legitimate needs, because it says like, oh, well, someone's high functioning, we don't need to spend too much time on them, or in schools we don't need to spend that much money on them, you know, because that's what, you know, as your mom could attest, like, you know, resources are money. But what it does is that it almost says that it delegitimizes their needs, and it almost erases them, and it says that, well, we don't need to spend that much time and that much money on them, and we don't need to focus on their needs as much as we do quote unquote low functioning. At the same time, I'm not a fan of the term low functioning, because I think that it sets the expectations criminally low for people who need around the clock care, who might not be able to speak, who might have intellectual disabilities. It says that it sets the expectations low, and it says that, well, they're never going to amount much to anything. So on one end, it says, like, you could wind up saying, well, we need, you know, they're going to need 24/7 care. But on the other end, it's like, well, do we really need to spend that much money if they're low functioning? They're not going to amount to anything. So in some ways, I feel like the terms high functioning and low functioning do a disservice to autistic people of any type. You know, calling someone low functioning doesn't really describe what they need. So I tend to prefer the terms high support needs or low support needs, because it's more descriptive of what they need rather than how they are perceived. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. And I think what you're describing is when you have something like the autism spectrum, which runs from people that need, you know, almost 24-hour care to folks that you wouldn't know unless they told you, folks like you that kind of self-identify. When you have that wide of a thing, there really does seem to be a major issue of when you're talking policy, now you're talking money, now you're talking recognition. There's a gatekeeping issue element to all this, and I think that's part of some of the things you're touching on in the book is, and why you kind of went with the personal stories trying to tell them is, there's a gatekeeping issue with these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So one person I interviewed is a person by the name of M. Remy Yergo. They're a professor at the of English at the University of Michigan, and they were diagnosed in college. And what was interesting was that they had this, is that people almost said that, oh, well, you're asking for accommodations because you're being whiny, because like by virtue of them being at university, they couldn't possibly be disabled. When we know that's not true, you know, we wouldn't say that to a person in a wheelchair, right? We wouldn't say that, oh, well, you can't possibly be disabled because you're here at university and you can get around campus. But somehow we think that's okay for autism, for ADHD, for other things. So we wind up erasing their experiences. And then but also by saying that someone's low functioning, we almost exclude them from really important conversations. We exclude them from talks about education. We exclude them from talks about independent living. We exclude them from so many discussions to their detriment.
And one of the things I really appreciate the book, and it's We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation by Eric Garcia. You really need to read it. I really enjoyed it. One of the stories in the book, because you use these people to tell the stories that really struck me because it goes to that parenting part of this, was the Williams family, Corey and Chris. You have
this whole
family unit. And I say unit on purpose because they're all together, and it's like all these things that are kind of disparaging narratives in the autism discussion, they all have it in-house because they're all like that, and they're all facing it together and pushing forward, and I found that to be a very powerful story.
Let me just go on record as saying I love Chris and Corey and their kids. I was really not sure about writing a chapter about family and relationships, but then my editor, as editors should do, kind of pushed me toward it. And in the end, I was already going to San Francisco. I was already going to the Bay Area, and I went, and they were the perfect kind of, they set the tone perfectly, because I think what it did is that there are so many anxieties about autistic people becoming parents or parents worried about their kids' fates once they get the diagnosis. I think that if you were to have Chris and Corey here, they would tell you being autistic makes them better parents for Calvin and Charlotte Ruby and Cassidy. Their children, it helps them understand their kids and it helps them be in tune with their kids in a way I don't think that they otherwise would. And also them having their children be autistic helped them understand themselves. So I think that was also just important, was they grew up in a time when there wasn't a lot of understanding about autism, but because their children grew up in a better time, that actually helped and in some ways saved them and helped them be great parents. And I think they're just the loveliest people I've ever met. So
you're not just, you know, the writer here, you're also a journalist. When you approach a family like that and you're trying to put that, you know, journalist hat on of like, okay, I have to interview these people, how do you even approach something like that? Because, you know, they're obviously tight-knit. They obviously are used to people, you know, not necessarily even in a bad way, but just questioning them and the curiosity level of something like that. How did you even approach that? Because I know that's got to be kind of touchy to some folks. How did you get in with them to kind of get the wonderful stories that you got out of it?
Chris reached out to me initially because we were just writing about his experience with work, because I knew a guy who I interviewed in the book by the name of John Marble, who's just one of the most fascinating people I've ever met. And Chris just stood out to me. I'd seen a few talks of his about the work that he does, making the place that he works, Square, making that more accessible for autistic and neurodivergent people. And I just thought this guy's interesting. And then he told, and then I read something that he wrote about his how he got diagnosed, and it was through his daughter. And then he mentioned that his wife was autistic, and then he mentioned his other two kids were also on the spectrum, and that really. And then like I was just like, so we already had interviewed, and we had already spoken. And then I just I said to him, I think that I could I would love to speak with your family, and I would love to visit your family. I'm already going to be going to the Bay Area of California. I would really love to visit your family, and you know, I promise. And I think it was also because I'm also autistic, and because we have that similar kind of shared experience, that allowed me to that kind of. You know, obviously, I still needed to build trust through other ways, but that showed that I'm from that community, and I know what it's like to be misunderstood, and I know what it's like to get to not be fully to have your humanity questioned. So I wanted to show him that I wanted to prove that his family was just as legitimate as any other family, and. I went in with that mindset of how do I write about a family that's autistic, and then I walked away with my expectations. I walked away with my expectations exceeded because I thought I was just going to write about him and his wife, and I thought I was just going to talk with them. And then throughout the day, you know, as you know, you have kids. It's like, you know, the kids were coming in and out, and they were talking with me, and they were talking with the parents, and I was really able to get this picture that I didn't even expect I was going to get by seeing just in some ways they were your average normal. Family in the Bay Area of California that was and it was just that they were autistic. That's the only difference, and that animated how they are parents. But it also didn't. It wasn't a detriment. It just meant that their family was different, and they adapted and they adjusted accordingly, and it made them better. And it made them a better family.
You mentioned John Marble. He was the other one I was going to ask you about anyway, because the story of how he. Started dealing with his own autism just blew. You want to talk about the people 20, 30 years ago that had their stereotypes. Here's your stereotype breaker right here with his story. So tell folks about that, because that one just blew me away.
John's story, for those who don't know John Marble, and I hope I've been getting on him to write a book because his story is just fantastic.
Oh, yeah. I'd buy it.
He got his start interning in the Clinton administration, and he wound up working for Al Gore's presidential campaign. If you ever have him on the podcast, ask him about his stories with Al Gore, because he's got some stories. And then what happened is he worked on various campaigns. He worked for the Stonewall Democrats. He worked as a journalist for a little bit, and then he worked on the Obama campaign, and then he worked in the Obama White House, and he was a presidential appointee. And it was while he was there that he realized that he thought he was going deaf. And then he went to his doctor, and then he kind of saw the autism diagnosis creeping up on him. And then finally he had a breakdown when he was visiting his friends, I guess out of the, like for a cabin trip. And then he had a meltdown and he realized, okay, I know that I have autism. And in the meantime, he talked to a friend of his who he knew he was spitting at work. And then his friend, then another guy by the name of Ari Nehman, who was the first openly autistic presidential appointee. He was introduced to him and they kind of met. And then I've known Ari for many years now. He did this thing where he kind of screwed with him, where they had coffee at not too far from the White House. And then Ari noticed that, you know, John, you're kind of overwhelmed. Why don't we go back to my office where it's a little quieter? And then when they went back, then John realized, okay, yeah, I know I'm autistic. Because he realized the sensory processing things. But John now, so he continued working in the Obama administration. He worked on the Hillary Clinton campaign. And then now what he's doing is he helps consult companies to help autistic people find good, fulfilling, integrated, meaningful labor and employment. And so it's fascinating because he went from being in complete denial that he was autistic, because he was just like, no, that's not me, to fully embrace, not just embracing this identity, but also wanting to give back to this community and make sure that they can live the most fulfilling lives now. And he's just, an incredibly dynamic and an incredibly brilliant and incredibly just open-hearted person. Like, everybody I know who has met him just falls in love with him. And in interviewing him and getting to know him, I fell in love with him as well. Like, he's just fantastic.
I get to follow you, and I've seen how the book's being reviewed and response, and people, the response has been really, really good. But what we don't get to see, because you're up in front of it, and you've talked about the responsibility of this, but we don't get to see the people you wrote about. How have they kind of been doing? Because we've also had the pandemic since you started this project, and now, so obviously we're dealing with people that, you know, have sensory type stuff here, and everybody's had a rough 18 months or so. How are they responding to the book? How are they doing? We see that you're doing great and we're thrilled for your success, but how are those folks doing? Have you been in touch with them? These great stories that we connect with, you know, how are they doing now?
You know, some of them have had COVID, and that took a toll on them. Others have done really well. I know that Chris and Corey, they still are raising their kids. They're still, you know, trying to help their kids with school during a pandemic. The Rosa family is, you know, the other family I profile in the Bay Area of California with Leo Rosa, they're still, you know, plugging away. They're trying to make sure that their son Leo gets, you know, all the services and accommodations they need. Lydia Wayman is still still living with her family, and she's no longer in, she's not at institutions, and she's living interdependently with her family, which is good. So I've been in contact with them, and I've been really, adamant about trying to maintain contact with them. But I mean, they, you know, at the same time, the thing that you think about is, cause, I know that I've been plenty fortunate to get through this pandemic. Thankfully, I haven't been sick, but I was reading one study a few weeks ago, even saying that, autistic people in Pennsylvania were 2.5 times, I believe, more likely to die of COVID-19 than neurotypical people. And a lot of that is just because they're in congregate care settings it can be just a death trap for COVID and a petri dish. So it's still tough. And a lot of people are still having trouble coping with it and dealing with the isolation and dealing with finding work or finding employment. But others are trying to pluck away, and, you know, they're all trying to navigate it. So it's tough for, you know, they're doing the same thing we're all doing.
Your day job is actually to cover Congress now. You're spending a lot of time in D.C. in the halls of power or vacation as of late. Policy-wise, we touched on it earlier, but, you know, the ADA is 30-some years old. The IDEA is about the same age. Policy-wise, what's going on in that realm of these things? Because you've talked about, we have this generation now that are in their, you know, 30s and 40s. Policy-wise, what's really coming, do you think?
So the real things that are really being discussed right now as far as disability. So what happened is, President Biden and Democrats are trying to are trying to pass through the reconciliation package with the budget resolution. As part of that, they proposed spending $400 billion in Medicaid home and community-based services, which is to say that you can receive your service, disabled people and elder people can receive their services instead of an institution. They can receive it in their home, because right now the wait list, depending on what you read, is for it is, can be anywhere from like 700,000 to 800,000 people. I've heard stories of parents putting their kids on the wait list in Texas as early as 11 or 12. So that they could get their services when they're teenagers or when they're 18 years old. So that's the big fight right now. Spending $800 is getting that $400 billion on home and community based services, and it's going to be very, very, it's going to be a slog, and it's still being a slog because, as you know, moderates like your buddy Senator Joe Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema don't necessarily support the whole $3.5 trillion. And but it's going to be tough. The other thing that happened is earlier this year, as you know, the minimum wage was not included in the COVID relief package. That would have raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. But what was also included is it would have ended sub-minimum wage. Because right now it is legal to pay disabled people below the minimum wage with something called a 14C waiver. That, of course, the minimum wage increase failed. But that would have also ended sub-minimum wage labor and sheltered workshops. The other big fight that's going on is there is also a push to include in the budget resolution raising the amount for supplemental security income to 100% of the federal poverty rate. Right now, it's something like 79%, I believe. This would raise it to 100% of the federal poverty rate. So that's the other big fight. It's not, I don't think, in reconciliation yet, but I think but there's a push to include it in the final reconciliation bill. So those are the big fights coming down the pipeline. But what's interesting is that you've seen even in Republican states that aren't necessarily big fans of raising the minimum wage, in places like South Carolina, they're debating ending sub-minimum wage labor. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican and not anybody's idea of a squish, signed legislation to end it so that people who do contracts with the state of Texas can't pay disabled people minimum wage, sub-minimum wage labor. So that's another fight that's been going on. You're seeing some incremental success.
It's been a boon to a lot of families, but the SSDI system has never been a real good, perfect fit for folks like things like the autism spectrum. Is there any way to really? I know part of it is just out of design, and you gotta get the help where you can get it for these families. But at some point, there probably really should be some reform and some breakdown of, hey, there's different kinds of disabilities. We should have different kinds of systems instead of just hobnailing everything into one system, right?
Right, and I think the other
I know
thing
that's Pollyannish,
that,
but it's a problem.
It is a problem, and like I hate to be Mr. Doom and Gloom, even though that's kind of my brand. But it's like there's almost no cliff. It's like either you have too many assets and you're off the cliff, or you have enough. So like you basically people are stuck in poverty, and then also I don't think that these programs were made with autistic people in mind. Because there are some people who are disabled who probably can't work, but because they're not seen as disabled enough, they still are denied that, even while they have trouble finding work. So they're stuck in this kind of feedback loop. On top of that, as I said, it's below, it's even the amount of assets you're allowed to have is below the federal poverty line. So it's not even that you have to live in poverty. You have to live below poverty to even be eligible to receive these services. And there's no way to it's not like you can, if I get a job and I start doing it, that they slowly start tapering off this benefits. It's usually just all or nothing.
It's funny because the subtitle of your book is Changing the Autism Conversation. Seems to me like the big technology push now of, working from home, being able to be, creators in different spaces. This seems like it would be an absolute boon to folks who can kind of pick their own destiny, or folks that maybe need some sensory type things, where an office environment is probably just living hell for some of these folks, but maybe they could have a home environment they could work on. I think technology might be one of these things where it's going to run way ahead of the policy a little bit and really, really help some of these folks.
Yeah, my friend David Perry, he makes this argument all the time. I believe he has dyslexia, and his son is autistic and has Down syndrome. And he's written about this a lot. He says that everything that was made accessible during the pandemic has to stay accessible. And I believe that wholeheartedly. And I think, once again, the pandemic, like everything with disability, the pandemic had its pluses and minuses for disabled people. So on one end, like you said, it allowed you to create, when I'm working from home and I have my own office desk environment, I'm allowed to create my own environment so that it's not overwhelming sensory-wise. I'm allowed to have my headphones on. I'm allowed to do that. At the same time, I think that it also can make it difficult when you're corresponding with people when you're talking with your supervisor, things like that, because you can't read their facial expressions. So there's only so much you could say over chat or over Slack or over some kind of thing that you can't necessarily read from their facial expressions or their vocal inflections. at the same time, I think that it's also allowed people, it's allowed you to connect. As a journalist, it's allowed me to connect with people who I otherwise wouldn't have thought of. You know, as a reporter and as an interviewer, it has allowed me, it's allowed me to think, maybe I should reach out to people who can't necessarily speak with their mouths, but who can type and interview them and take them seriously and take their words seriously. I don't think I would have done that as much before the pandemic. So I think that one of the things that employers have to think about is, what were the things that allowed our disabled, and particularly our autistic employees and every other disabled kind of employee, what were the things that allowed them to be good and productive and be generally in a positive work environment that happened during the pandemic? And that what were also, in the same respect, what were the gaps and what were the things that we had trouble with that we can ameliorate whenever we do go back to the office or something?
Is that kind of maybe a more attainable goal for the near future besides just the policy stuff and things like that?
Because
when I talked to my mom about it, because she did special ed for 35 years. She goes from the late 60s when, you know, they didn't even know what some of this stuff was to the modern age. And if you ask her today about this stuff, she never quotes you educational stats. She always quotes quality of life. She'll quote you like, hey, when I started to where I retired, Down syndrome's double the life expectancy. That's the stuff she brings up. Is it more that we should be focusing, especially with the technology, especially with the ability of folks now to tell their own stories through social media and other means, we focus on that sort of part of this of, hey, we can just open up the world to all these folks through really readily available means. The policy stuff's kind of an uphill push, but this is something really easy we can do right now pretty much anytime.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can do short-term and long-term at the same time, right? I think that right now what we could do is we could focus on those things. Those are things we could do in the here and now. How do we make offices more adaptable? How do we change company culture? How do we, and then more importantly, how do we include people in the people who will be affected by this in the decision-making process? You know, one of the things that I haven't seen almost any company do as companies are debating whether to go back into offices is I haven't seen any of them talk about accessibility needs. But that is something that could be readily done because whether you know it or not, you have disabled people working for you. Even if they have quote unquote invisible disabilities and they're like me and you're autistic and you're not necessarily even included in the stats about diversity and inclusion, you have disabled people on your staff and you should be even just doing an open call to allow people to have a say in how these workplaces are conducted It could seem like the smallest thing, but it could move mountains. So once again, you know, like you said, that's a great thing for the short term. It just requires employers to listen, and it requires them taking it seriously.
Not to put you on the spot a little bit, but one of the reasons you and me get along is we both, you know, we're pretty successful. We're very blessed people, but we've also have life kick us around a little bit and to get us to this point. What is it that's changed with you? Because I know you didn't do a straight biography. You kind of told the story through these other people, but it's still you. It's still you on the page. Where are you at now where you weren't, you know, 2-3 years ago when you started this process with the book and kind of where you're at now and go, wow, that's where I'm going to take out of this process when I go to my next thing or as I go forward?
I think I learned to be more patient and more mature. You know, I'm a very impatient person. I like instant gratification. But I think the process of writing a book and then also also interviewing people where it may take them more time to communicate or they may not get back to me immediately or they have bigger health priorities or, you know, support or educational priorities and I needed to be patient with them. It made me more patient. I think the other thing is that I learned not to be so self-critical and because I think a lot of times what I do is I can be very, very self-critical and that can lead to very self-destructive things. I've worked on becoming less self-destructive. I'm not always perfect at it. I still do self-destruct at times, but I've learned to channel my own frustration in ways that I don't completely kind of sabotage myself. And I think the other thing is that I've learned to have more, the fascinating thing about this that I'll say is that meeting so many different types of autistic people, the goal of this was to show their humanity and to argue that they're fully deserving of being treated as human beings, but it also allowed me to be more charitable toward myself. I think that one of the things that I realized was like, okay, it's okay if I get burnout or if I have sensory or I'm overwhelmed by my sensory processing. It's okay that, you know, I have difficulty executive functioning or have difficulty staying on top of every task and every project. If I'm doing my best and if I'm doing my damnedest, then it can be then okay. And it's okay to also ask for help. And it's also okay to even when I, you know, come up short, to try again the next day. So it's allowed me. So doing this has forced me to be less hard on myself, which is something that, and it's taught me that there are also plenty of different ways to be autistic, because there are plenty of different ways to be human, and we should expect those different ways that we should treat those ways of being human, you know, as anything else. So I think that's how I changed.
Well, you did a great thing with this book. I recommend it to everybody. I did get to read it, and I appreciated that. We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Eric Garcia, you're still out doing events with the book, so tell folks where they can find the book, what you have going on with it, and also where they can find you on things like social media, my friend.
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at Eric M. Eric M. Garcia. That's where I tweet way too much. You can also find me. I'm going to be speaking at the University of Delaware on October 6th. I will be speaking at Quinnipiac University on October 29th. I will be on NPR's Life Kit through the Library of Congress's National Book Festival next week on September 7th. I will also be at the University of Chicago on November 12th. Then you can also buy my book wherever booksellers are. You can buy it on Amazon, IndieBound, your local bookshop. If you want, you can also request it at your library. If it's not available at your local library, we will get that through. So you can get it wherever you, it's also available on ebook, Apple Books, wherever fine books are sold.
And he also does a lot of reporting by day. So follow all that stuff too. My friend, I'm so thankful for the time for this, and I appreciate you. Thanks for the time, and I just continued success with it, because I think it's not only a good book, I think it's an important topic. So thanks, my friend.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
No problem, sir. You know, in an interview that Eric gave about what his favorite part of writing this book is, he said, and I'm quoting, "I consider interviewing people to be an immense privilege, and earning their trust to tell their stories is an enormous responsibility I take incredibly seriously. Autistic people have been misunderstood as long as autism has existed as a diagnosis, and oftentimes authors write about autism without autistic people's input. So I wanted to refocus them as the center of the narratives. The other thing was learning how many ways there are to be autistic in the world, and how none of them are any less valuable or more valuable. The more I interviewed other autistic people, the more I came to understand myself." End quote. One of the things I've always thought about when dealing with issues like this, maybe it's because my mom was a special education teacher, was that the thing you really need to take into trying to understand somebody different is that if you take the time to understand their experiences and the way they view the world, what's going to actually happen in the end is you're going to get a better perspective on who you are and understand the world a little bit better. Taking the time to consider other people's voices, and especially in a community where the people that are they themselves, that community, and dealing with those issues and circumstances in life, and letting them be their own voice, makes everybody better, because it gives us more perspective. It diversifies us in all the best ways. Why in the world would you ever want to silence voices on an issue like autism by not including the people themselves that are autistic? And while I understand in that community there's somewhat of a debate about whose voice and more and all these sorts of things, maybe those of us that are not in that community need to just do the takeaway of empathy starts with understanding that we need to do a lot of listening. And when we start talking about things like political policy and trying to help some of these folks, the first thing we need to do is have a little bit of humility of understanding that we don't know what's best for them. We should just listen to them and let them tell us how to help them best and how to get them not to a number or not to some policy goal or not to something, whatever arbitrary thing you want to set up. The goal of trying to help folks that are in a community like the autism community with policy is to let them have the most freedom and the most liberty and the best life they can possibly have as Americans, just like we should be doing for absolutely everybody else. It's a great book. I hope you pick it up. I thank Eric Garcia greatly for being with us. That's it for this edition of Heard Tell. We took a little bit of a break for a couple weeks. Folks were asking. Part of that was purposeful. We were going to take a break right around that time. Also, the Afghanistan situation happened, and we didn't want to comment on any of that until it was over. That'll be in forthcoming episodes. Continue to please follow and like and comment wherever you're listening to this, whether it's iTunes, Spotify, whatever. We greatly appreciate it. We're doing this because you listen and you've responded. We're well ahead of where we thought we would be with this program as far as listeners and people sharing it. So thank you very much for that. As long as you keep listening, we'll keep doing it. So until next time, wherever you and yours are, we hope this finds you well. We hope you all are happy and joyful and having the best life you can be. And until we talk to you again, y'all take care of yourselves.
All the music on Heard Tell is provided under a Creative Content license from MonsterCat.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.